There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest Wax Ecstatic. I am your host, Matt Salmon, and once again, I am so glad that you could join us for some classic cardboard conversation. And we're not just talking classic cardboard. Perhaps we should call this a classic cardboard combo conversation. Say that five times real fast. I'm not going to try. We're all about alliteration. Yes, broadcasters, writers, we're all about alliteration. And there is a combo here to talk about. In fact, co-op. Aha! Another C word there. Classic cardboard co-op combo conversation. Blah, got that all out. We are saying a mouthful here. And that's rather appropriate because we've got a very special show this time around. What I have lovingly called the foodstuff cards. We are talking about co-op baseball releases, mostly from the 1980s and 90s, although as we'll discuss, the marriage between baseball cards and food goes back a long time ago. In fact, almost to the beginning of baseball card history. And we're going to be looking at some of the often overlooked releases from the 80s and 90s. Some you know fairly well, in particular Coca-Cola, Squirt Soda releases from the 1980s. But some that you probably don't know too well because it was all part of the glut of the 1990s. And no, not just the fast food waistband expanding public health crisis in America at that time, which still reverberates 30 years later. But the glut of baseball cards, the hobby was booming in the mid-90s. Everybody had to make baseball cards back then. And you'll see some really ridiculous examples in this program. Perhaps you saw them in our video release, Wax Ecstatic Foodstuffs. It is on our YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe to the new YouTube channel for Wax Ecstatic. As I collected through some listener donations, through some digging around in my own personal collection, a pretty nice assortment of food-related co-op cards. Thank you again to Coach Mike, to Dave from St. Louis, and to a couple of eBay sellers. I was able to pick some of these up, and we'll get into the full details of each of these sets that we looked at. Some that you may want to go looking for. Others, you can pretty much move on from. But I remember back in the early 90s when the foodstuff cards were all the rage, and it wasn't just the typical post-cereal cards, which were no longer part of the back panel of the cereal box. No, they were actually wrapped nicely and deposited into your box of cereal, like most cereal toys were back in the day. It wasn't the Hostess cards that were also packaged, nestled in with your Twinkies and Ho-Hos and Ding-Dongs. No, these cards were everywhere. And you had soda, you had Cracker Jack, you had fast food. And I remember in the early 1990s, you know, I didn't go chasing these food cards. If I just happened to buy a product, or really it was my parents, if my parents happened to go grocery shopping and, you know, they bought Post Raisin Bran and there happened to be some baseball cards in there, that was a cool bonus. But one of the few exceptions was when I was about 15 or 16, and I was a connoisseur of McDonald's. I was also a fat kid. I should add that. Mostly because of all the stinking McDonald's I was eating as a teenager. Not just the Big Macs, but the copious amounts of Coca-Cola and French fries I was shoving into my pie hole then. I actually weigh less now than I did when I was 16 years old, believe it or not. Just a few pounds, but, you know, I'd broached the 200-pound buffer when I was about 15. I'm actually just under that now, so... Now, that goes to show you how much McDonald's I was eating back in the day. But one of the cards that I didn't get to too much in the video, I did show it at the very end, but the game day collector cards, these were football cards. I don't know if you remember these, but with baseball cards or sports cards just totally in vogue at the time, McDonald's had teamed up with Fleer. Fleer had made the game day card brand. And the Fleer game day cards were kind of like the Topps Tallboy football cards of the 1960s. Topps did the same thing with basketball cards, too. They were, I'd say, roughly 2.5 inches long and maybe about 4 inches high. And there were 3 sheets of 6 cards featuring star football players at the time. And I still have one. It was not kept in mint condition. I actually found this recently while cleaning up my house. We just had the floors replaced here, and we had the opportunity to just move boxes and boxes of junk that had been sitting on the floors of our closets for 8 years here. And at the bottom of a box was this sheet of 1993 Game Day collector cards, Sheet A, from McDonald's, 1 of 3, featuring Deion Sanders, Thurman Thomas, Troy Aikman, John Elway, Barry Sanders, and Sterling Sharp. Now, uncut, if I kept this in mint condition, yeah, I could probably sell it for a couple of bucks, but at the very least, it's a nice piece of 90s nostalgia that I kind of chuckled at. But it all brings me back to McDonald's. And we were frequent visitors to McDonald's, and I would go to the McDonald's counter and get my order and hope that they would have something other than Sheet A. And if I recall correctly, I had 4 or 5 Sheets A and none from Sheet B or C. Somehow the other sheets did not get to the McDonald's conveniently located in beautiful downtown Sefner, Florida. So what do I have? I had about 5 extra sheets of the same football cards and probably an extra 10 pounds and higher cholesterol because of it. But that was the chase. Sports cards were all the rage. Co-ops with food distributors and restaurants were all the rage. And like I said, it was all part of the bloated hobby and a bloated country. This was back in the Bill Clinton pasty white thighs and jogging shorts days. You know, we were fat and happy. And we've been paying for it ever since. Not just on the waistline, but still clearing out our cards over the years here. So it's kind of funny to look back at this because I remember those trips to McDonald's or, you know, trying to think who else would have had it because I didn't go to Denny's that often back then. We'll talk about the Denny's Grand Slam cards in a bit. And the other promotions that were going on at the time, I remember like bottle caps at 7-Eleven. There, you know, you got baseball card coins from Slurpees and stuff like that. It was just all over the place. You couldn't escape it. But as we will discuss in just a moment, it is something that harkens back to the early, early days of baseball cards that were aligned with some kind of corporate entity outside of the manufacturer of the cards. And it all goes back to, you know, that marriage of food and baseball cards. There was the corporate angle that came around starting in the late 1950s and 60s, and then just turned into a glut in the 80s and 90s. And I'm curious, with baseball cards becoming extremely ridiculously popular once again, and even Topps going public once again. I'm sure you heard that news earlier this week. Topps is valued at $1.3 billion. I'm pretty certain the 1990 Topps set is not part of that $1.3 billion. Certainly, I don't have that much money in my 1990 Topps set. But Michael Eisner and friends certainly made a pretty smart investment in the company when it went private back in 2007. But, you know, with baseball cards becoming popular, it's hard to buy them at stores. I still haven't seen any Heritage in a retail store. I'm going to have to go to a hobby shop to buy some. I finally got a couple of blaster packs from Topps a couple days ago. But with the increased popularity of baseball cards, I'm wondering if we're going to see the baseball card and food co-ops, the foodstuff cards, make a comeback here in the next couple of years. I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised. Although there's got to be an angle to it other than, hey, we're fill in the blank, you know, McDonald's, Denny's, Taco Bell, whatever. And we have baseball cards. You know, that's what it was in the 90s. Everybody had a baseball card. You know, every outlet had a baseball card. Even if the outlet was on its last legs financially, if it was Rack's Roast Beef, they probably had some baseball cards. But you got to go beyond that. There's got to be something special to it. But I'd be curious to see if that does happen. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. Just a reminder that Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday. Our next podcast coming up Friday, April 23rd. What are we going to talk about? I have no idea. Yes, for the first time in a couple of months, I have not planned this far ahead. I've been busy with work, busy, like I said, fixing up our house and doing some other odds and ends and just balancing everything. And I will be doing some eBay shopping soon. I do have a hunch that we might go back to the 90s a little bit. I've had some listener suggestions to do some Fleer Flair reviews. So I'll see what's out there. See what our robust United States postal system can deliver to me on time by April 23rd. And we'll also go searching around to dig up some classic sets. I've also bounced around this idea in my head of revisiting some sets. So I may go through the analytics from the podcast, all 180 previous episodes, maybe find some episodes that were listened to a long time ago that we haven't talked about these particular sets. We might unearth them once again. Take a second look at some sets from the 80s and 90s. So be on the lookout. There might be a poll for that on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Which set should we talk about first? And perhaps we'll unearth some gem, something that's been overlooked from many moons ago. Speaking of polls, we are still running our SurveyMonkey survey regarding the Wax and Gum Stains website. Yes, waxandgumstains.com. I have the domain. Looking forward to getting that website up over the next couple of months. It's a long-term summer project for me. I want to get it right. I want to make sure that it complements the podcast. We're not replacing the podcast. This is going to be something that lives alongside it. And we want to build it around your needs and expectations, your likes, what you want to see. So if you go to our Twitter profile, again at Wax and Gum Stains, you will see a link that says, help us build waxandgumstains.com. Click on that link when you get a chance. 5 questions. They're all multiple choice. Takes maybe 1 minute, 2 if you're a little slow. And tell us what you like about the show. What do you want to see on this podcast and on this website? And I will take that information and build a website around that input. And I appreciate everybody who has chimed in so far. We had a great response after my last call to action a couple weeks ago. Would love to have some more submissions. So again, if you have not done that survey, go to our Twitter profile at Wax and Gum Stains. Look in the Twitter bio. You'll see a link. And just click on that link. Take a minute to answer the five questions. And we will utilize that in building out the Wax and Gum Stains website, which again should come out later this summer. I know that seems like an eternity from now, but as I said, I've got a lot going on. A couple other things I have to prioritize, but this is just one of those things that I will be constantly working on over the next several weeks. So that's the latest on the podcast, on the website as well. Don't forget, cash donations are greatly appreciated. PayPal.me/WaxEcstatic. Also, cardboard donations. If you would like to send me some cards to discuss on the show, or if you want to help me build up a personal collection, kind of as a trade-off, you listen to the podcast, you like me, you want to send me a handful of cards to complete a set, you're more than welcome to. Email us at the new waxandgumstains@gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking, and I'll take a look at it. Now, a lot of listener donations helped set up this program, and I had a lot of fun going through my own personal collection, shopping around on eBay, going through a few boxes of cards that were sent my way. And I have a whole new appreciation for some of these foodstuff cards. Now, notice I said some of these foodstuff cards. There are some older cards that are well-produced, that have some stories behind them, and are neat little things that, as a collector, you should not overlook, you should not disregard a lot of these. Then there are some where you can just totally take it or leave it. And, of course, a lot of those come from the 1990s, mid-1990s. But there are some interesting ones from those years. And let's start with the brief recap of how food and baseball cards came together. And it almost goes back to the very beginning. Of course, baseball cards, part of an insert, a bonus to packages of tobacco and cigarettes back in the late 1800s. And that was looked down upon by some people. Of course, there's the legendary Honus Wagner story of how he didn't use tobacco or didn't like kids using tobacco, so he, you know, got his T206 card taken out, and that's why I should say Honus Wagner, as Keith Olbermann would correct me, Wagner's card came out of the T206 circulation, and that's why that card is bought and sold for millions and millions of dollars these days. So getting away from the tobacco angle, you had to lure kids somehow. Well, what better way to do it than with bubblegum and candy? And this goes back to the 1930s. And it's not just baseball cards. It was other cardboard collectibles that were made then. Along with baseball cards, you had history cards. You had cards of war. You know, a lot of history, sometimes revisionist history, with the Civil War, the Great War, also known as World War I. And you had these cardboard stories being told. And on top of, just having these nice little collectible pieces of cardboard, you had to have a treat. So that's where you had a piece of candy or a stick of gum that came in with the packaging. And like I said, it goes back to the 1930s. It was really popularized after World War II with not only Topps, but also Bowman bubblegum, as you had candy makers that were popularizing their candy products by attaching a baseball card or two with it. And that, of course, is why we have the name of bubblegum cards. That's what the cards were known as, really up till the early 1970s, when the focus went from buying a pack for the bubblegum and, oh, there's a couple of cards in there, to buying a pack of cards and, oh, there's that stick of gum in there. So the hobby changed from being candy first, baseball card second, to collecting the baseball card first and discarding the stick of gum second. That happened in the early 1970s, but really from, you know, the late 40s through the early 70s, these were still known as bubblegum cards. And that was still the focal point, even though the money, the collecting came through the cardboard. It was still Tops, and for a while it was, Bowman selling, you know, their below-knee baseball bubblegum in these packs, and the cardboard was just an extra thing. In fact, you could argue that these gum makers were wrapping their gum in cardboard to try to keep it fresh. Didn't work real well, but you catch my drift here. So there's always been a relationship, or almost always. Again, we're coming up on basically almost a century of a relationship between some sort of food, in this case a candy or some other confectionery like a cookie or bubblegum, tied to baseball cards. And over time, the confectionery went to the wayside while the focus was on the cardboard product that was being packaged and distributed. But going beyond the main product of the Topps Chewing Gum Company, you started having baseball cards show up with other food products. And of course, the best examples are the post-baseball cards from the 1950s and 60s, and the Hostess cards that also cropped up right around the same time. And not only Hosts, but also Drakes, you know, a lot of baked goods. Basically, a product that had a longer shelf life than fresh fruits and vegetables and meat and stuff like that, but something that wouldn't sit on a shelf forever. You know, it had to be consumed within, in the case of, you know, a loaf of bread, you know, a couple of weeks, or if it's a box of cereal, maybe up to a couple of months. Not that your sugary cereal sat on your cupboard shelves that long. But there was an immediacy to it. This was something that was going to be consumed within a few weeks. And on top of that consumption, you've got an extra prize inside. And what better way to get kids to eat cereal than putting it in your post cereals? And yeah, you had your Raisin brands for post, but you also had your Alphabets. You had your Sugar Crisps, you know, you had, or Cookie Crisp, I should say. I don't eat a lot of sugary cereals anymore, but you get it. Yeah, there are a lot of legendary post, cereals from back in the day, where to get that edge over a Kellogg's or a General Mills, you had to insert these baseball cards. And when Post was lucky enough to get some well-renowned, nationally known superstars, such as Mickey Mantle or Roger Maris, to star in a TV ad campaign promoting these baseball cards, well, guess what? That was incredible exposure. Every kid wanted to be Mickey Mantle, or every kid wanted to be Roger Maris and break a record that Babe Ruth had set back in the 1920s. So, hey, if Mantle and Maris say, eat your Post Raisin Bran, damn right, Mom, go get me some Post Raisin Bran. Please. And that, of course, fueled the baseball cards throughout the 1960s and 70s that were associated with dry goods. So again, cereals, baked goods, cookies, little spongy Hostess Twinkie cakes, stuff like that. Now, throughout the 1970s, the Players Association, realizing that there was money to be made in these cards, and Major League Baseball as well. This, of course, fuels the backstory behind the Fleer lawsuit against Topps. And once Fleer wins that lawsuit in 1980 and it opens the door to competition against Topps for the first time in 25 years, suddenly it's not just Major League Baseball, but it's also the Major League Baseball Players Association that is making money here. And Marvin Miller was a really big driver, big factor in getting the players to allow this to happen, to have their likeness used elsewhere, to draw in revenue streams, as small as they may have been at the time, into creating these products. Because for the longest of time, players would sign an exclusive contract with Topps they would get paid like $125 a year to be featured on baseball cards. And that was that. It increased starting in the late 1960s. And again, as there was some more products being released in the 1970s, they started seeing some more gains there. And of course, it exploded in the 80s when there were some more legitimate, officially licensed products that were out there. So you start seeing these special co-branded, co-opted baseball sets coming out in the late 70s, because it's not only the Baseball Players Association that sees the money. It's not only Major League Baseball and Topps that start seeing the money, but it's also the co-sponsor that sees the added benefit. Because by the late 1970s, it's not just kids collecting baseball cards. It's now adults. We've talked a lot about 90s nostalgia, how people today are throwing it back to 25, 30 years ago when they felt good about everything. Well, think about it. Let's say it's 1980. You know, I've got a small pack of Squirt 1980 Topps baseball cards here. So it's 1980. You're in your mid-40s. You're going through the post-Jimmy Carter depression. You want something that makes you feel good. Hey, let's bring it back to the good old days. Well, what did I do 30 years ago in 1950? Oh, yeah. Used to go down to the corner candy shop or the corner drugstore. 10 cents would get you 10 pieces of candy. And if I really wanted to splurge, if I gave a nickel, I got that one package with the bubble gum that came with a couple of cards. And all throughout the next few years, I collected these cards. And oh, Mom threw out all those cards. Damn it. Well, let me go out and get some cards now. That's right. The adults were getting into it. And by then, there were values placed on the cards. There were conditioning guidelines on the cards. And you had the best of both worlds. You had the young kids who were buying them to find their favorite players. You had the older adults buying them to feel like they were kids once again. So there was money to be seen from the league, from the players, from the manufacturers, and then from the sponsor. So if your Squirt soda in 1980, and you know they had done a couple of releases before, if your Squirt soda, you're not only selling these little mini three-card packs to the adults who want to feel like kids once again, you're selling it to kids. And who is buying those six packs of Squirt soda bottles or the 2-liter Squirt soda bottles? It's not the kids. It's not the 9 and 10-year-olds. They're not going into the big supermarket. No, it's Mom and Dad. It's the adults. The kids see it. Mom, Dad, can I have Squirt? Well, why do you want that? They've got baseball cards. All right. And they would reluctantly buy it. You would suck down that great sugary wonder that was Squirt soda. And you would get a handful of baseball cards, which was a neat find. So everybody won. Topps won because right before all the competition hit the ground running, Topps had an edge. It wasn't just retail outlets or baseball card hobby shops. No, now their product was right in the aisles of grocery stores. And people put the Topps name next to baseball cards, and that's what gave them such a huge edge over Donruss and Fleer over the next few years. So when I look at these 1980 Topps Squirt cards, you see cards that are essentially 1980 base cards. You know, it's almost like splitting the main set up here. And the quality of these cards are outstanding. You know, it's just your standard 1980 Topps baseball card. And in 1981, I've got some samples here. Again, thanks to Dave from St. Louis for sending me the Phillies team set. You've got some great players. If you look at the Phillies team set here, they're individually numbered for the team. And they're different than the base set for Topps, namely that the Coca-Cola logo is prominently featured in the upper right-hand corner of these cards. And also when you flip the card over, in the upper left-hand corner, very similar to how the team logos were placed on the back of 84 Topps cards. And you still have the quality of a Topps baseball card from 1981, good card stock, same colors, just that extra Coca-Cola branding. And you saw this too in, let me backtrack here, 1979 with Burger King. Burger King was another, very cognizant corporation that saw the link between pulling kids and families into the restaurants by offering up these cards. Basically, Topps reprinted the entire 1979 set. In fact, I was fooled. I have, who was it? Is it Mike Schmidt? I think it's Mike Schmidt card from 79. I was organizing my 79 Topps set. That's going to be one of the next hand-collated sets I start putting together. And I had this Mike Schmidt card, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, wait a minute, this card number doesn't match up. Oh, wait, no, it's one of these Burger King sets. Oops. Or a Burger King card, not the whole set. But it was basically a redo of the base set, just released through Burger King. And I had ended up with this Phillies subset and this Mike Schmidt card. And it got dropped into my base set hand collation. And there was a little confusion there. But this is a big deal here where Topps basically mirrored their base set for these side sets. Now, with the competition coming out in 1981 with Fleer and Donruss, Topps had to alter it just a little bit. And gone were the days of pretty much the spitting image of sets. And if you look at our video, you'll see the 1982 squirt sets. First of all, the front of the cards are completely different from the 1982 base set. And in a good way. First of all, a really cool green and yellow combination. Those were squirts colors. And it's just an awesome color combination. Plus a very 1980s MTV look to it. You know, slanted photos, kind of a fun font with the team name. And on the back, you have the same design as the back of an 82 Topps card, but different colors. It was white cardstock with a predominantly yellow, black, and black or yellow back and black printing, which was different from the base set, which of course had the 70s green, the last of the green ink that was still around Topps factories at the time. And you have that purplish text that was on top of it. So this is much easier to read, but the flip side is that the squirt baseball cards, the cardstock was a lot flimsier, almost 81 Donruss-esque. So the differentiation is a good thing for Topps, but they decided to scale back on the production quality of these cards. So while the 82 squirt cards look nice and have a little bit of a tease to the base set on the back, they don't stand up as well as some of the previous issues. So we go through the 1980s and you continue to see baseball cards injected into various food products, again, breakfast cereals, Cracker Jacks, Soda Pop, all throughout the 80s. But then we've got the explosion in the 1990s, where the baseball card hobby is going through the roof. It's an industry. We now no longer have one card maker, nonetheless three in 1981. Now you've got, six or seven, and then you've got the offshoot brands of all the main companies. For example, the Game Day football cards from Fleer. You know, that's a subset of a subset, basically. And now it's starting to get out of control just a little bit. And you have some of the cards that I had featured in the video, including the 1994 Yoo-Hoo Gold Glove Award collector cards. And this was a double co-op here. I don't see the manufacturer names. It almost looks like a Fleer card. I may look this up later and try to figure this out here. It almost looks like a Fleer card, but it doesn't say Fleer anywhere on the card, if you catch my drift. They're designed to look kind of like the 87 Topps cards, but they're very noisy with the Rawlings logo in one corner, the Gold Glove logo in that same corner, the Yoo-Hoo logo in another corner. You know, they tried to mishmash 87 and 65 and 62 tops all together here, and it's just a lot going on. But if you're interested in Hall of Fame players, many Hall of Fame players who have won Gold Glove Awards before, such as, Bob Gibson and Roberto Clemente and Thurman Munson, then this is definitely a set that you'll like. This was released in 1994. Also, during this time here in the 1990s, you have Conn's and Hillshire Farms. Yes, the sausage makers creating a Cooperstown collection group of cards, almost cartoonish, like a cheap knockoff of Turkey Red cards. We also found the Stouffer's cards here, which were kind of this poor man's 3D card, where if you set it up properly, the Donruss pop-up All-Stars, remember those from the 1980s? You kind of had the same thing here, where once you pulled the card together properly, the player would leap out in 3D action while showing off the stats. And the one that I have is Bob Feller. So we have Bob Feller in wind up here as he's going through the pitch. And you know, it's a neat little trick here, but it's amazing how all of a sudden complicated and how intimate some of these cards are. You know, it's not just good enough to get a card on the back of your cereal box. Now you've got to pull a tab and set this up, and you've got Bob Feller standing up in your Stouffer's French bread pizza. And then it would continue even more egregiously, mostly through fast food chains and sit-down restaurants. Denny's is the best example. Denny's teamed up with Upper Deck in the early 90s, taking advantage of Upper Deck's hologram technology and releasing the Denny's Grand Slam set. And in order to be part of the Grand Slam set, you had to be a player that had hit a Grand Slam in your life. So I have, for example, a 1992 Jose Canseco Denny's Grand Slam card. It is all hologram. It's just a picture of Jose at the bat, Bay Bridge of Oakland in the background. You flip the card over, there's narrative, no stats, just a little story about Jose Canseco hitting Grand Slams in his career. And it would move on to really detailed holograms. And by 1995, I believe it was, the partnership between Upper Deck and Denny's dissipated. Pinnacle comes in and creates the next generation of Denny's Grand Slam cards, to where even players featured on here, you know, having a Grand Slam was optional. In fact, as we'll discuss in our bottom third players here in just a few minutes, you had pitchers here too. It's not that a pitcher can't hit a Grand Slam, but by 1996, 1997, you're getting away from the Grand Slam portion of the card, the reason behind the card, and it's just becoming more of, hey, here's who's famous now in baseball. It's going with the hits, you know, the star players, as opposed to an actual Grand Slam being hit. Now, some of these, again, are very intricate, where you've got these 3D cards in 1996, these hologram cards, where if you move the hologram from left to right, you can see the hitter in the swinging motion hitting that home run. And it's actually, you know, quite a neat effect. Or in the case of Hideo Nomo, who we'll be talking about, you've got him in his tornado delivery. And it's like I said, it's a really neat effect. And you got it free with your Grand Slam breakfast. Or really, I think at that point in time, it was if you just ordered any entree, a non-alcoholic drink at Denny's, you got this thrown in with your meal. Which also makes me wonder, was there ever alcohol served at Denny's? And if so, how did I miss out on that? Boy, 1995, 96, if there was beer at Denny's, I would have been at Denny's. Not at IHOP or Waffle House, sopping up all of my alcohol from earlier that night in a stack of pancakes or hash browns, scattered, smothered, covered, and topped, of course. By 1997, Pinnacle and Denny's, they outdo it again, where the front of the card, it's kind of like the sports flicks cards, the 3D action. You move the card back and forth and the player kind of moves with you, and then you flip the card over and there is a hologram headshot of the player. 1997 was also a very special season, the first season that baseball honored Jackie Robinson, the retirement of the number 42 on April 15th, coinciding with the 50th anniversary of Robinson breaking the color barrier in baseball. So there's a Jackie Robinson card in that set. Also, 1997, the All-Star Game was played in Cleveland, and there was a limited release of Larry Doby cards marked set or card one of one, supposedly handed out at Denny's restaurants in the Cleveland area or the upper Ohio area during that time. So there's a little scarcity to it. If you could track down a Larry Doby 1997 Pinnacle Denny's Grand Slam card. There's also scarcity in some of these other cards I was talking about. Going back to the 81 Topps Coca-Cola set, there are no Yankees cards, or at least not many, I should say. Some initially got out, but the Yankees had ended their relationship with Coca-Cola. And well, when the boss says we're not doing anything with Coca-Cola, that extends to baseball cards too. So Topps had to put the kibosh on those cards. Also, Carlton Fisk was a member of the Boston Red Sox in 1980, would sign with the Chicago White Sox heading into the 1981 season. Well, the Red Sox team set had Carlton Fisk in it. So after an initial press run, Topps stops the presses and removes the Carlton Fisk card from the Red Sox set. But some of the Fisk cards got out. In fact, I saw from, I believe it was 2017, a former Topps worker who caught wind of this secretly ferreted about 500 of these Red Sox sets, stuffed them in his duffel bag and took them out of the factory. And here he was, what, 36 years later, putting them up for auction. That lot of 581 Topps Coca-Cola Red Sox sets with Carlton Fisk in a Red Sox uniform was sold for, I want to say, $2,300. It was over $2,000. So if you're able to find a Yankees 81 Topps Coca-Cola card or a Carlton Fisk 81 Topps Coca-Cola card where he's in a Red Sox uniform, congratulations, you have a big payday. But generally speaking, if you have these food cards, not worth a ton, especially the cards from the 90s because there are so many of them out there. But if you have some from the 70s or early 80s, or certainly as we have discussed before, those post-serial cards from the 1960s, you do have some cards that have some monetary value. If you want to look beyond monetary value, though, I would suggest doing a little digging for some of these foodie subsets from the 70s and 80s, and yes, even the 90s, and here's why. First of all, if you want cards that are basically base set cards of some of the top baseball cards that were out there in the late 70s and early 80s, then finding that Burger King card or that Squirt soda card or the Coca-Cola cards, those are neat additions to your own personal collection. And especially because the Coca-Cola cards were released in team sets, unless you really want to go out and try to collect the entire collection, at least what is publicly out there, as long as you're not a Yankee fan, you can still find your favorite team and have a nice little Coca-Cola team subset that is different from the base set cards that came out in 1981. The Squirt cards are neat, and I'll say too, with the cards from the 1990s that I have, it's a neat collection of Hall of Famers for the Yoo-Hoo or the Hillshire Farms cards. Even the Stouffer Bob Feller pop-up is kind of neat. The Denny's Grand Slam cards, you know, that was part of a collection of cards that my buddy Coach Mike delivered to me. There was just a box full of cards, and about 50 of these single card packs for Denny's. And I opened up every damn pack to see what was inside. So there's plenty of those still around here. But if you're interested in some neat hologram technology and Hall of Fame players, okay, that's one of the reasons why the card hobby has spiked once again, is because there's no guessing as to who's a star. So if you're looking for, Frank Thomas or Barry Bonds, already he's not officially in the Hall, but you could argue he could be, Jeff Bagwell. If you want some Ivan Rodriguez, Mark McGuire, some legendary players from that time, such as Darren Dalton, Kirby Puckett, they're out there for you in these Denny's packs. And because these were all mid-90s releases, and chances are there were too many made, remember, these were to be given for free with any entree and drink purchase at Denny's. So that means there are millions of them out there. So there's not a ton of monetary value, but there are some neat assets neat features of these cards that you may want to look at. So don't spend a fortune on these. Even the ones from the early 80s, you'll spend a little more than some of the cards from the 90s. But it is worth your time to kind of look through and see what there is in the offering here, because there are some pretty neat cards that were released at this time, whether they were the spinning image of the base set, in the late 70s or early 80s, or if they were something completely different. Even if it is a knockoff 87 Topps card with these 1994 Yoo-Hoo Gold Glove cards, or kind of a poor man's Turkey Red card with the Hillshire Farm cards that were released in the mid-90s. If you're interested in Hall of Fame players, or at least some interesting 90s technology, these are certainly worth a look. And I'm somebody who is somewhat converted here. I never really paid much attention to the food co-op cards. Certainly back then, like I said, unless I happened to be at McDonald's during this promotion, or if my parents happened to buy that box of cereal that had the baseball cards, I wasn't actively seeking these things. And it's the same now. I've never really done deep dives for Coca-Cola or Squirt, or certainly Hillshire Farms baseball cards from 25, 30, 40 years ago. But going through this whole pile of cards here, again, from some eBay sales or some donations from listeners, this was a fun unearthing here. And I'm going to keep some of these. Some of them I'm giving to my son. But to some of these I'm going to keep, not because I want to build a set, but because I think they're very neat pieces of history that I do think will come back again. I think it's inevitable, just because baseball cards are so popular. And I know, there's more of a digital angle to baseball cards now, not just with like the Topps bunt, but, with Topps getting involved in cryptocurrency and stuff like that. But it just seems so natural. There's got to be another food and baseball card relationship. And maybe when Topps goes public and, there's stock involved, then maybe they're making those decisions. Okay, it's time to reach out to those, official sponsors of Major League Baseball and start up another food-based, release here. So it'll be interesting to see if that does come to fruition. And if it does, I'd be curious. I'd look into it. Maybe not at the depths that I would have a regular base set, but I think you could find some very interesting food co-ops today as you did in the 90s, although hopefully not as plentiful, or certainly during some more creative times in the 60s and 70s and early 1980s. So I had a lot of fun looking through some of these cards. I hope you had fun looking at the video at some of these cards and listening to me talk about them. And I hope you dive into them as well. Some of these, as I said, because there were so many made, they're plentiful, they're cheap, and they're kind of neat. They could be fun little additions to your quote-unquote serious baseball card collection. All right, it's getting late in the program, so let's head to the bottom of the order here. We've got three random selections from all of these food cards, and we've got a couple of familiar names and one name that may not be too familiar to you, but it's got an interesting story, and I think I'll actually start with that one as I'm going to go chronologically through these cards. I'm going to pick one of the 1980 Topps Squirt cards. I'm going to pick one of the 1981 Topps Coca-Cola cards from the Phillies team set. And I'm going to pick one of the 1996 Denny's Grand Slam cards. And we're going to start with that 1980 Topps card. Steve Mingori, better known as Mingo, a native of Kansas City, Missouri, a leap year baby. Yes, born February 29th, 1944. He was an outstanding young prospect growing up in the rural Kansas area. Like I said, he was born in Kansas City, but grew up near Pittsburgh, Kansas. He was a star baseball player at St. Augustine Catholic Grade School and later on at Rockhurst High School. In fact, he was inducted into the Rockhurst High School Athletic Hall of Fame back in 2007. Attended Pittsburgh State University, later Friends University as well. A star youth player at the Ben Johnson Baseball League, was the league MVP in 1963. He was a league champion in 1964, and even in rural Kansas, catching the attention of scouts, he was signed as an amateur free agent by the Cincinnati Reds in March of 1965. Now, he would work his way through the Reds farm system, never played for the Reds, however, as the Reds traded him in February 1970 to the cross-state rival Cleveland Indians for Jay Ward. Now, it would be with Cleveland where Mingori would make his major league debut. In fact, made it in the 1970 season, August 5th, 1970, against the New York Yankees. And for much of his career from this point moving forward, he would be a relief pitcher. Did make a few starts in his career, not that many, though. In fact, a grand total of two, one with Cleveland and then one with Kansas City. That's right. Mingori would find his way back to his home team, and it was a rather fortuitous trade from Cleveland to Kansas City. Happened in June of 1973 in exchange for Mike Jackson, as he was able to leave the depths, the floundering Cleveland Indians organization, and get moved to an up-and-coming Kansas City Royals team. Now, as I mentioned before, he was in relief for pretty much all of his career except for one start in his final season in 1979 in Kansas City. He was a very reliable reliever, typically had an earned run average under three. Was brought into some save situations several times. Of course, Dan Quisenberry was the more notable closer for the Royals at this time, but Mingori would do it every now and then, and was a pretty reliable pitcher, too, when it came to control. Yes, he offered up quite a few walks, but also managed to strike out a lot of batters and get a lot of batters to ground into outs. So this was a guy who could come in, face a couple batters, get the job done, and help this up-and-coming Kansas City team make the playoffs three consecutive years, American League West division winners in 76, 77, and 78. Did not get to the World Series with Kansas City in 1980 as he was released by the team following the 1979 season at the age of 35. So where did Mingo go? Well, Mingo would become a coach. In fact, he was a minor league pitching coach for the Toronto Blue Jays through much of the 80s and early 90s. In fact, starting in 1986 through 1993, he would be a coach at various stops along the way, Syracuse, Dunedin, Myrtle Beach, and Knoxville as well. So if you are familiar with or you're a fan of the Toronto Blue Jays and their glory days of the early 1990s, chances are the players brought up through their farm system, guys like Pat Henken, Juan Guzman come to mind, Todd Stottlemyre, David Wells. Chances are they crossed paths with Steve Mingori, and they were able to learn a thing or two from Mingo. Sadly, Mingori passed away of natural causes in July of 2008. Much beloved pitching coach, much beloved community member of the Kansas City, Missouri area, and in fact, had a public memorial service at Kauffman Stadium in July of 2008. Pretty solid southpaw reliever and featured in that 1980 Topps Squirts Squirt soda card, not squirts. Squirt card. You're going to get the squirts if you drank too much squirt. Card number 219 with the Kansas City Royals. His swan song, since he did not actually play for the Royals, in 1980. Now, who beat the Royals in the 1980 World Series? Yes, the Philadelphia Phillies, and one of the key members of that team was the Sarge, the Ministry of Defense, or Secretary of Defense, I should say. He's not British. No, he's Gary Maddox. Gary Maddox, a native of Cincinnati. His dad was actually a pitcher in the Negro Leagues with the Cincinnati Tigers. Shortly after he was born in 1949, the team moved to Southern California in suburbia Los Angeles, in particular the San Pedro area. Not exactly a very lucrative part of town, if you know what I mean. So he grew up on the rough side of the tracks. Grew up along with seven, I believe, brothers and sisters. Or no, eight, I'm sorry. Nine kids for the Maddoxes, my goodness. And baseball was the one thing that saved Gary Maddox, as he was able to excel in that sport, be spotted by a San Francisco Giants scout, and he would sign with the Giants after getting drafted by them in the second round of the 1968 draft. Now, like every other youngster at this time, he was drafted not only by Major League Baseball, but by the U.S. Armed Forces. In 1969, he was sent over to Vietnam. A 19-year-old having to deal with the pressures of Vietnam did see some combat, thankfully not some of the worst fighting that was going on in the jungles at that time, but he certainly saw the ripple effect of how it affected others in his platoon. There was a friend of his who committed suicide. It was just, as Maddox would say, pure hell. How did he get out of a four-year commitment with the Army? Well, he was rather fortunate for a couple of reasons. One, his father was in ill health. He had suffered through multiple heart attacks. So Maddox was able to apply for a hardship discharge to take care of his family. And the loophole in the platoon charge was you could get that hardship if you also had a job. Well, thankfully, because he was the property of the San Francisco Giants, he went to Giants management and said, "Hey, I need you guys to sign me to a contract and put me to work so I can take advantage of this." And that's exactly what the Giants did. Now, an interesting potential side effect that would become part of Maddox's trademark look. Gary Maddox had a rather bushy beard, which was not all that surprising for ball players in the 70s as they started growing out their facial hair. But Maddox suffered what he thought was a side effect of Agent Orange. He had this very itchy facial skin after his time in Vietnam. It was very sensitive. He couldn't shave without hurting himself. So he just grew the beard out. And the legendary, nearly trademark Gary Maddox beard became part of that. I thought that was pretty interesting. So the Giants bring him on board. He is coming up through their system. And after a slow start by the outfielders for the Giants in 1972, including a broken arm for Willie McCovey, an aging Willie Mays, well, Maddox gets the call up April 24th, 1972, does extremely well. And, well, it's pretty obvious at this point in time that he's going to replace Willie Mays. And this is a bit of a catch-22 for Maddox because he idolized Willie Mays as a kid. But because Maddox was doing well and Mays was declining, Mays was traded to the New York Mets on May 11th, 1972. And poor Gary Maddox had the tough task of, quote-unquote, replacing the Say Hey Kid in center field. Now, there were some other issues going on in San Francisco at this time. Of course, Horace Stoneham, that ownership was starting to play out its last days. The Giants did not invest a lot of money in their farm system. They did not invest a lot of money in keeping veteran players. They didn't invest a lot of money in Candlestick Park. In fact, Candlestick Park at this point in time was basically becoming a football stadium for the 49ers. So things are going down the drain for the Giants. The team is losing. Attendance is not that good. And Maddox is also having some run-ins with the managers at the time, getting platoon, not getting some regular playing time. And he, in 1975, demands a trade. So the Giants decide to go ahead and trade him. May 4th, 1975, they send him to Philadelphia for Willie Montanez. And the joke was, per Larry Boa, when he heard about the trade, Boa said, "Who else are we getting?" Yeah, Maddox was a little under the radar at the time. Montanez was a fan favorite, but the Phillies gave up on Montanez to bring in a much-needed asset. They needed somebody patrolling center field ever since Del Unser was moved, and Gary Maddox definitely fit that reputation. Now, while Maddox did not like playing on the artificial turf at Veterans Stadium, he certainly enjoyed the atmosphere at the Vet, certainly more than the stick at the time. And he would become one of the key cogs in that up-and-coming Phillies teams of the mid to late 70s and going into that World Championship in 1980. In fact, he is one player a lot of people tend to forget. In fact, when you're looking through this 81 Topps Coca-Cola set, you see the familiar names. You see Larry Boa. You see Bob Boone and Pete Rose and Mike Schmidt and Steve Carlton and Tug McGraw and, you know, there's some other names that stand out. Greg Luzinski and Bake McBride, Manny Trio, Lonnie Smith. And, oh, yeah, there's Gary Maddox. Well, don't sleep on Gary Maddox. He would come up with some big hits, some big defensive plays as well, hence the name Secretary of Defense. And he would also become a key contributor, to the Philadelphia community, especially. And thanks in part to his upbringing in some rough neighborhoods in Southern California, he was a guy that went to the projects and took care of a lot of kids who were struggling, a lot of families that were struggling. Now, Maddox would have a couple of boneheaded moments, particularly in the 1978 NLCS. The Phillies had a chance to tie up the series at two games apiece in game four against the Dodgers, but a couple of muffed plays by Maddox, rather unexpected, eventually would cost the Phillies the chance to win the National League pennant. The Dodgers would go on to the World Series, losing to the Yankees that year. But once he got over those hiccups, he would continue to play a key part in the Phillies' resurgence and ultimately in them winning the World Series in 1980. Now, he had some contract squabbles with the Phillies organization. He also had some injury issues as well, consistency issues too, but he was able to battle through pretty much all of those to really stretch out his career with the Phillies. In fact, he would be part of what was lovingly known as the Wheeze Kids, the play on the old Whiz Kids name of the 1950 Phillies that made it to the World Series. Well, the Wheeze Kids of 1983 got to the World Series. They would lose to the Baltimore Orioles that year. By this point in time, the 33-year-old Maddox, again, platooned, a veteran presence, managed to appear in 105 games in 1985, but after a brief stint of play in the beginning of the 1986 season, he would play his last game in the major leagues in April of 1986 before the Phillies went, "Nah, you've done well enough for us." And he was still part of the organization, but he was not an active player. Now, what has Gary Maddox done since his playing days? Well, what hasn't he done? He's done a little bit of everything. Like I said, a very big contributor to the Philadelphia community. He still continues to be a contributor to the community. He also became a business owner, built the Worldwide Concessions, Inc., also later bought the A. Pomerantz and Company office furniture chain. And on top of that, he was also part of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. He served on the board of directors for the Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce and the Fed Reserve. And he's also done some broadcasting. He's done a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And that's not so bad for a kid who grew up on the poor side of town in Southern California and went through some pure hell in Vietnam in 1969-1970. Last but not least, one of our Denny's Grand Slam cards from 1996. And again, this is when the Grand Slam kind of was removed from the criteria to get one of these cards. By 1996, Pinnacle was just creating cards of whomever was popular. And there was no other pitcher certainly of a foreign background, who was as popular in 1996 as Hideo Nomo. Hideo Nomo, born in Osaka, Japan, August of 1968, much like Fernando Valenzuela was to baseball in 1981. You know, during that split season, the strike year, Fernando comes through, opens the door for Mexican-born players, just dominates from the mound, helps the Dodgers win a World Series in 1981. Here comes Hideo Nomo, really the first big star to come out of Japan. And he was an absolute stud and really opened the door for many Japanese-born players later on in the decade. You may remember some of the incredible and in some cases ludicrous bidding wars that teams had just for negotiating rights to Japanese-born players. I believe, what's the number, 58? I believe 58 total players have come from Japan since Hideo Nomo has. And I mean, you're talking about Ichiro, you've got Daisuke Matsuzaka, Hideki Matsui. I mean, so many Japanese-born players who, after playing in the Japanese leagues, when becoming free agents, they would come over to Major League Baseball. Well, Hideo Nomo was really the first and the biggest because he had a lot to lose. He really took a big risk after starring in his native country. In fact, in 1988, he was part of the silver medal winning Japanese team in the 88 Olympics. He was offered contracts from eight teams in the 1989 Nippon Professional Baseball Draft. So he signs with the Kintetsu Buffaloes, received a bonus of 100 million yen. That was roughly $1 million back then. That's a pretty significant bonus for a then, 21-year-old kid whose only, quote-unquote, professional experience was the Olympic Games. And so, you know, he's getting, you know, roughly $1 million up front. That was pretty significant. And one of the big reasons why he signed with Kintetsu is they told him, we're not going to change how you pitch. Whatever's comfortable for you, you go ahead and do that. And what was comfortable for Hideo Nomo? Well, what was called the tornado delivery. He would really, corkscrew his body and his delivery, which hit the ball real well, and that's what surprised a lot of pitchers. He didn't have an overpowering fastball or really deceptive breaking pitches. They were good pitches, but by being able to hide that ball in that lanky 6'2 frame of his, he was able to find a lot of success in Japan. Now, he had his agent fight for him to get some free agency. His agent was Don Nomura, and he found a loophole in Nomo's contract. And in fact, a lot of Japanese league players had this loophole where if you retired, once you became active again, you became a free agent. So, you know, you quote unquote retired, but didn't actually retire. You just retired from the Japanese league and then you moved on either to another team or, in his case, to another league. And Nomo started getting the feelings for Major League Baseball during the international barnstorming tours of the early 1990s. In fact, one of his biggest advocates in the early 90s was Randy Johnson. Johnson saw Nomo pitching during these international exhibition games, and he told Nomo, he's like, you need to come to the United States. You belong in the major leagues. And that was quite the compliment, especially coming from an up-and-coming star in Randy Johnson. So his agent finds that loophole. Nomo becomes a free agent, and he's got numerous teams chasing him, including Johnson's Mariners in the winter of 1994-95, and he decides to sign with the LA Dodgers then. So Nomo becomes a quick fan favorite, not only with the Asian community in Southern California, but also with baseball fans in general. And boy, did they need it in 1995, following the player strike and the cancellation of the World Series in 1994. Nomo comes in and he just starts dominating pretty quickly. In fact, he throws a no-hitter in Coors Field in Colorado. That's not exactly easy to do, especially since it's a hitter-friendly park, a mile high, and also against a pretty potent lineup for the Rockies. That actually happened in 1996, I should say, September 17th, 1996. Also in the 1996 season, struck out 17 batters in a 3-1 win over the Florida Marlins, and he would continue to star as a member of the Dodgers for the next couple years. Dodgers would make the playoffs, but did not certainly win the World Series or even make it to the World Series during that time. Of course, while the Dodgers were trying to do that, they had plenty of competition from the Atlanta Braves, who were pretty much a buzzsaw in the National League. Now, after winning Rookie of the Year honors in 1995, also an All-Star in 95, having that great 1996 season where he finished fourth in Cy Young Award voting, slips a little bit in 1997, has a really bad start in 1998, which coincides with the Dodgers dismantling their team in 1998. Of course, the biggest trade that season was Mike Piazza. They trade him to the Marlins, and then eventually the Marlins flipped him to the New York Mets. Well, the Dodgers would send Nomo straight to the Mets June 4th, 1998. Nomo, along with Brad Klontz, in exchange for Greg McMichael and Dave Malicki. So clearly, just a swap of spare parts that were going on here. And Nomo would finish up the 1998 season with the Mets. Nothing special there in his time with the Mets, as the Mets were also an up-and-coming team. They wouldn't become real contenders until the 99-2000 season. Released by the Mets in 1998, he signed, or in spring training of 1999, I should say, would later sign with the Milwaukee Brewers, spends one season there, would later spend the 2000 season in Detroit, then serves the 2001 season in Boston, where statistically he didn't have an outstanding season, yet he had another no-hitter, his second career no-hitter in another hitter-friendly park, Baltimore's Camden Yards. So quite the feat, those two no-hitters that he got in Denver and in Baltimore. After the 2001 season, he returns to the Los Angeles Dodgers as a free agent. Dodgers once again competitive and contenders, and he would find some success in that pitcher-friendly Dodger Stadium in both the 2002 and 2003 seasons. Was injury-prone, to say the least, in 2004, just really came off the rails. In 2005, signs with the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. There was a stipulation in his contract that he would receive a big bonus if he made it to 20 starts, and part of the reason why that stipulation was in his contract was the Rays were not really sure that Nomo was fully recovered from shoulder surgery that he went through in 2003 and, like I said, really struggled through in 2004. Well, he starts 19 games and coincidentally, just 2 days before he's supposed to make his 20th major league start, the Devil Rays cut him. And some people go, well, is that just a coincidence? I can tell you, as a fan of the Tampa Bay Devil Rays back in 2005, no. That was Chuck Lamar and Vince Namoli not wanting to spend an extra $700,000 on Hideo Nomo. So he's picked up off waivers by the New York Yankees, but does not pitch for them in the remainder of that 2005 season. Signs contracts with the Chicago White Sox, later the Kansas City Royals, and actually does get a little bit of pitching time in 2008. Nothing to write home about. 3 games, 4 1/3 innings, allows 9 runs, all earned, and 10 hits for an impressive earned run average of 18.69. The Hideo Nomo days were over. His playing days were pretty much done at that point in time. So in the end, you look at Hideo Nomo's numbers in Major League Baseball, 123 wins, 109 losses, a 4.24 earned run average. Not extremely impressive. Decent strikeout to walk ratio. In fact, about a 2-to-1 strikeout to walk ratio. But again, really struggled down the stretch there and kind of became a footnote in baseball history. But much like Fernando Valenzuela had 4 or 5 really dominant years and then just tailed off as his career went on, same thing with Nomo. Comes in at 26. Rookie of the Year in 1995, has that impressive 1996 season, has a couple of decent seasons afterwards, but career kind of tails away. But much like Fernando Valenzuela, what he did for Mexican-born players, it should not be forgotten what Hideo Nomo did for Japanese-born players. And like I said, you had Daisuke, you had Ichiro, you had so many others. Some did better than others, but the door was really kicked open by Hideo Nomo in 1995. And his, unfortunately, his career was not Baseball Hall of Fame worthy. In fact, he only got 1.1% on his first ballot in 2014. But the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame inducted him in his first year. He got 82.4%. So he is part of the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame. He, along with Victor Starfin and Sadahara Oh, are the only people elected to the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame in their first year of eligibility. And he became the youngest player ever to be inducted at the age of 45. Now, his son, Takahiro, is part of the Nippon Ham Fighters. He's a team translator for them. Also, Nomo has worked with the San Diego Padres over the past few years as a team representative and a little bit of a scout in the Pacific Rim. So don't forget what Hideo Nomo did to the game of baseball, even though his overall stats, you kind of overlook them because they're not Hall of Fame worthy, even though his career tailed down quite a bit because of injuries. Well, you know, let's not forget the contributions, and he certainly made a big one, not only to Japanese-born players in Major League Baseball, but adding the unusual element of a pitcher to the Denny's Grand Slam Pinnacle Hologram set of 1996. Well, there we are with the bottom of the order, and that will wrap up our podcast. A lot of fun, like I said, going through some of these foodstuff cards. Some of them I'll keep. Some of them will be handed off to my son. Others will probably go to our donations to Commons for Kids, because there are some pretty neat cards here. I just don't want to hang on to them. But I do again suggest, if you haven't already spent some time looking at some of these food-related co-op cards, specifically from the 70s through the 90s, it's worth a look. You may find your favorite player, your favorite team, or if you're somebody who collects Hall of Famers or award winners, a lot of these sets were based around those type of players and their accomplishments as well. That'll wrap it up for our podcast this week. Again, we will be back 2 weeks from today. That will be on April the 23rd. And what we'll talk about, it'll be as big of a surprise to me as to you. So we'll all learn together, right? Follow along in our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains to find out more. And don't forget, on the Twitter profile, you'll see the link to the waxandgumstains.com survey. We want to know how to build that website for you. So please take that survey. It only takes a minute, 5 questions. It'll help out tremendously. Speaking of helping out tremendously, we're getting closer to that finish line with COVID. We're almost there. Please, even if local laws start getting scaled back, folks, let's get across the finish line together. Keep wearing those masks. Keep washing those hands. Keep socially distancing. If you can hang in there for like another month, maybe like 4 to 6 weeks, we can beat this as a nation and we can finally start getting back to normal. So don't spike the football at the 5-yard line. Let's get across here, get into the end zone and get her done. Okay. And get those vaccinations, please. I got mine, or at least I got the first vaccination several days ago. I get my second in a couple of weeks. I just had a sore shoulder for a couple of days. That's all. And it wasn't my pitching arm, so I was able to still throw batting practice to the Little Leaguers. So please get those vaccinations. They are free. They do not cost anything. The lines are not that long. They move, and they will get you back to normal quicker than if you hide in your house even longer, okay? So go ahead and do that for your good, for your health, and for the health of your family and this nation. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We will see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands, Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.